Good evening. Welcome to A Feminist Perspective. This program is brought to you by the Women's Resource and Career Planning Center, which is located in the Dean of Women's office. We've collected a wide variety of materials and of personnel in this office, and we're eager to discuss with you any problem that's of concern to you. We hope that you'll come in to read materials, to talk with people, and get help with whatever problems that you feel that you have. Tonight we're going to be discussing consciousness-raising groups. This term has a very special meaning, but I suspect it also has some very individual meanings to a lot of different people. We have three panelists, Cindy Cassie, is that right, Cindy?
Yes.
Who's a junior in the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences at the University of Kansas. Connie Loskett, who's also a junior in the college at KU, and Quincy Lee Striegel, commonly known as Q Striegel, that's what we'll call you tonight for convenience, who can be defined as either a faculty member at Ottawa University or a graduate student at KU in speech. And I'd like to start by asking you folks, Cindy, why don't you start? Tell us, when did you first hear about the consciousness-raising groups, and how'd you get involved?
That's really hard to say. I heard of them for quite a long time before I actually got into one. The first consciousness-raising group I got into was this semester in Ellsworth Hall with, well, it started with two other friends of mine who also wanted to start a consciousness-raising group. So the three of us simply put up signs and said we were going to start one.
Is that how you got in, Connie, in the same group? Did you see the sign, or were you in on the discussion?
Oh, I was asked my opinion, and I helped put up the sign.
I see. But, how about you, Q? When did you first hear about them, and how did you get involved?
Well, of course, I think we'd all heard about them for a long time in terms of, you know, if you've done any reading in the feminist movement. My first experience goes all the way back to the sort of fatal spring of 1970 here on campus, when we had all of the problems going on campus and classes ended earlier than a lot of us had expected. At that particular time, they formulated a lot of seminars on various subjects that might be of interest to students who were not formally attending classes. And some of the groups that I went to involved women's issues. There were some people here, mainly people from out of town at that point, who were interested in starting women's groups in Lawrence. So it's kind of interesting. One evening, these two women who were doing this work had a meeting in their apartment, you know, just sort of posters around campus, as you girls did, and saying, you know, anybody who's interested in women's groups sort of show up. So I went with two other friends of mine, and we were interested in a group, and it was kind of a situation where they said, you know, okay, you eight go off and be a group. So I had, you know, three people that we knew and five others that were total strangers. So we went wandering out of their apartment, and the nearest place that we could find to hold our first meeting was in the lounge of the ladies' room in the KU Union. So from that, we started our group, which lasted for approximately 2 years. There were probably about 15 people that were in and out of the group. Of course, it was somewhat of a transient society here. There were three of us who started with the group and ended with the group during that whole two-year period, and you know, many others that were in and out. But most of them were fairly stable. Most of the people who were in the group were in it for at least a year's time. And so that it was a very intense kind of long experience for all of us.
Well, I expect we'd better say first of all, what is a consciousness-raising group? You said that this meeting was called in the spring of 70 to just talk about feminist issues. There are lots of ways of talking about feminist issues. Is any way when a group of people get together called a consciousness-raising group? Or does this have a special meaning?
I think it has a special meaning for me in that it means dealing with very personal kinds of things rather than dealing with what we might think of as social issues or public issues or the kind of thing that you would go out and try to do by passing legislation or repealing laws or formulating new laws or these kinds of things. It deals with women getting together on a very personal level, very quietly, very grassroots, very spontaneous, and talking about the things that really seem important or significant to them as individuals. That's why I think the nature of the groups tend to be very different according to the kinds of persons who are involved in the groups and things that are important to them.
Would you folks agree that this defines the consciousness raising group?
Oh, quite a bit.
Well, what about, what do you call a group that gets together to, say, discuss changing legislation? Or do you assume that there's already an expertise there, a knowledge of themselves and what they stand for? Or does that have a special name?
I don't know if it has a special name or not, but it's not a consciousness-raising group, and that probably these women have already had their consciousness raised to the point where they know what legislation they want passed and things like this, whereas a consciousness-raising group just starting maybe hasn't gotten that far yet.
Would it be possible to, let's say that there was something which someone felt very strongly ought to be done. We use example the law again, a law that needs to be passed or one that needs to be changed, and you, but you don't have unanimity of opinion about it because there are some women who would neither know nor care whether the law existed or not, or wouldn't feel personally involved with it. Suppose you got together a group like that, and try and there was a discussion of what those needs were. Would it still not be a consciousness raising group?
Oh no, I have a feeling it would still raise a lot of consciousness, simply because dealing with differences of feeling and opinion is always a learning experience and something that makes you more aware of how other people are acting and reacting. Mm-hmm. Well, a good example of this that I think is very predominant in the women's movement would be repeal of abortion laws. Some people feel very strongly that the laws should be stricter than they are, and some people feel very strongly that there should be no laws whatever regarding abortion. And in that way, you have an opportunity to learn from each other. You know, why do people feel as they do? And it becomes a sharing experience, which I always think is consciousness raising in an ultimate sense.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's a lot of room. Well, one of the things I really like about the women's movement and the small group is the fact that there is a great deal of room for differences of opinion, and those opinions generally find a great deal of acceptance. You know, everyone has the right to feelings that are of a different nature. I don't think there's any one line that runs throughout the feminist movement at all.
Mm-hmm. Do you know about the beginnings of the consciousness-raising groups, of what the point was, and of whoever started the first one and starting it? Anyone heard about that? I've read some interesting things that I just wonder you might react to them. One woman in New York who was very active in some feminist groups there withdrew from a consciousness-raising group. Because she said they never did anything. It never led to action. The ones that you've belonged to, have you expected that when people's consciousness were raised, that action would result?
You mean like going out and working towards repeal of laws and things?
Mm-hmm.
I haven't. I felt that action was being accomplished in how they related to other people, you know. Like if they could change their relationship to other women and other men, they accomplished something.
I have a feeling that you girls are both, you know, fairly new in terms of consciousness raising, and my group has ended, essentially. And the one thing that the people who were involved in my group was that it took us a period of, and for us I think it was longer than most, you know, most consciousness raising groups don't last 2 years, but it took us that long to get to a place where we felt like we were ready to commit ourselves to public action. You know, and it was a long time of going through very personal, traumatic experiences and very personal kinds of changes, and it completely changed our relationships with frequently families, friends, husbands, other women, boyfriends, whatever it may be, you know, a lot of very profound changes were going on in personal lives. I think you have to get through those kinds of problems before you can go on and commit yourself to working for passing equal rights amendments or repeal of abortion laws or whatever happens to be the thing you want to become active in.
Also, our group, I think part of the reason that neither Connor nor I expected our group to do anything like that, like working for legislation or anything, was that we got started so late this year, like we were just barely getting started at the beginning of this semester, and didn't really have time for anyone to decide on anything to do along that line.
Well, the other problem is when you're going to school, you're busy, you know, you don't go out and do a lot of things like that.
But as your consciousness is raised, has it been your experience that the individuals in the group, then not necessarily the group as a whole, which got together for one purpose, that the individuals became more committed to the idea of desirable change, or are they satisfied just to communicate, relate to one another?
I don't know. I would think, well, it's been my experience that they become kind of angry. They become so angry that they have to go out and do something. Just the situation becomes intolerable.
Have you followed up on the people in your group, Q, as to what, how active did they become?
Well, some have become very active, and some have become very committed in other things. For example, one of the girls is now in law school, which I think is partially a result of her experience, and of course is very committed in that direction now. Two of us from the group have formed now chapters, one here in Lawrence and the other one that I started last February in Ottawa. And so in that way, we have tried to get together other women who perhaps have been through the consciousness raising question, you know, in a situation, or just women who are interested in doing things. For example, the group that I'm involved in Ottawa is interested in doing community kinds of works. A girls' recreation program for this summer, which is highly slight, you know, the very active boys' recreation program for the summer, but a very inactive girls' recreation program. So they're doing those kinds of community works. And, of course, most of them are housewives and mothers, a few students. And so, you know, a lot of those have gone on to other things. I would say mostly, though, there have just been very personal changes, and most of the women that were in our group are not now really involved in a lot of active work. They have perhaps changed their own lives and the direction of their own lives, but are not now involved in more public kinds of commitment.
So actually what I'm hearing you say is that you don't think one thing necessarily leads to something else other than a greater understanding, and which might or might not lead to action. So you would not accept then the criticism of people who say that if you study something for a long, long time and get such satisfaction out of just the study of yourself and of one another and the relationships, that that this is not a suitable end in itself.
No, I wouldn't say so. I think here again it becomes a very personal kind of thing. Some people really want to go on to active things, want to get involved in public issues, and some people just want to affect their own lives in a very personal way.
Do you did you have anyone in your groups who already were quite active and moving toward change, but still hadn't resolved some of their own personal problems?
No, the people in our group who were already involved in working towards any kind of a change at all were also fairly much together as far as their own personal lives were concerned, too.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. I just have never been in a group that's called itself a consciousness-raising group, but I have been in groups who have been very much committed to change, and I was not real sure everybody in that group, even though they knew all the techniques, really were, as you put it, together and at peace with themselves about you know, how they would go about it.
I was wondering if it was necessary to be together before you could, before you worked on legislation.
Oh, I agree.
I wouldn't think so.
I wouldn't think, in the sense in which we're using that, being together, that this would be essential, although it certainly does help, because it means that you're not as easily diverted from your cause if you really understand why you're engaging in it. In a recent MS magazine, there was an article on consciousness-raising groups called rep groups. Is this a common name that's given to CR groups?
sometimes I think if you were talking, particularly in a social sense, where there are lots of people not familiar with the women's movement, I will sometimes call it a rap group, because in some situations that's perhaps a little less threatening, mm-hmm. where they think you just get together and rap, and all kinds of people do that. But if you call it consciousness raising, it identifies you much more closely with the feminist movement. And in some circles, that's still a rather threatening thing for people. So I think frequently you'll hear them, and it's also shorter. You know,
it's a, do you have any theories on why that ought to threaten anyone? They get that people get together to raise their own consciousness level?
Well, some of the interesting things that happened to me in a smaller community like Ottawa, when I, and I wasn't even the one who suggested formulating the Now chapter there. It was some of the women who came to me and said, we want to do something, and we know you've done it in Lawrence, so why don't you get us together and have a meeting some night? And the reaction from the husbands, a lot of the women that are in this group are faculty wives, is their sort of label. And a lot of the husbands that are colleagues of mine on the faculty would come up to me with little, you know, with smiles on their face, but at the same time remarks like, housebreaker, you know, homebreaker, what are you doing? You're just going to ruin all of our lives, and your wives don't cook dinner for us anymore, and then you're going to go off and leave, you know. And there will be stranded with all these radical women.
They didn't have much of a conception of what the National Organization for Women is, did they?
No, not right now.
Hardly a very radical group.
Right.
Did you invite them to come? They're welcome, aren't they?
Yes. Yes, we did invite. Some of them joined, as a matter of fact, and several of them came to meetings, I'm sure out of curiosity, found out we were not, you know, going to burn the town down and do anything very radical. I gave a talk to the Kiwanis Club there recently about what the Now chapter was about, and it was very interesting. The associate pastor of the Baptist Church came up afterwards and said, oh, I think you allayed a lot of fears, and I was glad to know that I had taken care of some of the fears that they had of what we were going to do. So
it does seem strange how much time one spends in allaying other people's fears
right.
over
mm-hmm.
what shouldn't really threaten anyone.
No.
The let's talk a little about how you get started. Suppose that you had a group of people that were talking and decided that they'd like to talk some more about how they feel about things and about other women and about themselves. Any suggestions on how they could go about it?
Well, okay. In our group, we did have a little bit of trouble getting started right at first. People would just come and say, well, I don't have anything to talk about. Do you have anything to talk about? Do this for a while. But one night, one woman came and said that she wanted to talk about whether she felt she could trust the other women in the group or not. And this helped us get started. We all told a little bit about ourselves so that we would know each other somewhat better and got into things a little bit more through the channel of talking about who we trusted and why we trusted them and if we trusted the other women in the group.
Mm-hmm. I actually think that's a good question because the trust issue comes up very, very soon, I think, in almost any small group, and because, especially when these are very personal groups. You have to trust each other before you can say very personal things about yourself and about your feelings. And then also you have to trust each other to be able to say, be honest with each other, you know, to tell each other problems that you see, any kind of reactions that you have toward the other person. So I think, you know, the trust issue is one that very early comes up and is a very important one.
Is there more of an inclination in the groups that that you've known about personally to believe that one sex or the other is more trustworthy, more to be trusted?
Because I think this is all part of the fable of
anyone.
Our society. Is, you know, women are sort of trained that women are gossipy and catty, which you learn this, but my experience always denied what I had learned. I found that women probably gossiped less and were less catty, or certainly no more so. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe it's a very individual thing. Some men are very gossipy, some women aren't, but lots of women aren't and lots of men aren't.
How could you be sure that in your group, are these groups of friends, or can they be strangers, or can they be a combination, or what's the best technique there in getting a group together? Which would you rather be in, a group of strangers, acquaintances, friends, what, or a combination?
I felt comfortable knowing at least two or three people that I would consider friends in my group. But I was very pleased to see people come in that I didn't know or were friends of friends, okay? Because that added a whole new dimension, somebody new to experience. And this, I think, can be a very exciting process to develop yourself further rather than just get to know better everybody you already know, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, Cindy, or me in a group?
Yeah. Well, in our group in the dorm, it was a little bit different than this, because in a dormitory, people know each other at least by sight.
Right.
So everyone was acquainted to a small extent, and some of us were already fairly close friends who were getting into the group. But I enjoyed having some people there that I knew, too. I felt more comfortable. But I wish there would have been more people that I didn't know.
If you were in a strange city and somebody asked you, just an acquaintance, to go with them to a consciousness-raising group, and you got there and you didn't know any of them at all, what kind of a situation would that be for you? Would that be a comfortable one, uncomfortable, or how would you feel?
Well, I would feel somewhat more comfortable than with a group of total strangers anywhere else, I think, because the fact that they were in a consciousness-raising group would mean that they felt the same way that I did about things, about the feminist movement, for example, would be the biggest one.
Well, how do you know there's not someone who came because she was a gossip and wanted to get some good stories to tell?
Well, what difference would it make? I mean, they probably wouldn't get back to me, you know, if they were total strangers.
What if they were friends? Or acquaintances? Or is that really the issue? I take it you don't start out by...
You don't start out assuming that.
When you don't start out by talking about highly intimate matters, I suppose, either, do you, the first day?
No.
You? Why not? It's certainly not because you think someone's going to go and tell it. Why is it that you wouldn't, that wouldn't be a good way to start?
I think pretty much like in any group, though, you here again it goes back to this issue of trust. You start off on a fairly common level of talking about, you know, who you are and what you do and what your family's like and what your experiences are like. And then you gradually work down to, well, why are you here, kind of thing. Well, I'm here because I, you know, felt different kinds of problems in different situations, or felt put down in situations, or I'm curious because I wanted to find out what this kind of thing was all about with some of the reactions that we got. And gradually then, as the weeks go by, you just get more and more personal, but this element of trust builds up to the point where I think at a certain point you know that you can trust everyone in that group,
mm-hmm.
and or they wouldn't be there.
Yeah.
You just have a great deal of faith.
Did you use any special techniques, or just a kind of a give and take, discussing whatever came up in the groups that you belong to?
We used very much a technique of just give and take. It would be particularly if someone would come to a meeting and have a problem that she particularly noticed or that she wanted to discuss. And sometimes these would be personal problems with family, with children, with things they'd run into at school, with things they'd run into with boyfriends. With things that they had happened to them at jobs or work or job interviews and things like this. And usually somebody would come saying, "Ugh, I had this horrible experience this week," and they would, you know, and one thing would lead to another. And
So there never was any planned agenda?
No.
Was there in yours?
A few times, maybe once or twice, we had a planned agenda. For instance, when one woman in the group mentioned that she didn't know if she could trust the other people in the group or not, that led to another one or two sessions where we planned to talk about exactly who we trusted and who we didn't trust and why.
Mm-hmm. I noticed that the article in MS said that one of the questions with which some sessions were begun was, why did you come? You know, why are you here? And I suppose that could lead to your response if somebody had a particular problem, but then there would be others. Can you recall any of the other kinds of reasons? What would people have said if you started out with a question of, why did you come?
Some people wanted to find out what they were.
Right.
What the consciousness-raising group was.
Oh, what
was.
The group was?
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. What women's liberation was. Mm-hmm. We even had one woman that wanted to know more about the movement.
Mm-hmm. Anything else that you can think of?
Some of them that I found wanted to find out more about themselves as individuals, that perhaps they were going through a time of either being dissatisfied with what they were doing or feeling trapped if they were at home all the time. And this was kind of their thing, to get out and to be able to talk about themselves, to relate experiences back and forth, to say, you know, this is my problem. Has anybody else ever had that problem? What'd you do about it? Kind of thing.
And didn't usually other people have the same kinds of problems that they brought up?
Almost universally, mm-hmm. Yes.
Right. I understand that's one of the big advantages, is that right. To the discovery that the thing you thought was very peculiar, a problem peculiar just to you, that it's not peculiar to you at all, but pretty universal.
Time and time again, there was this great relief of, oh, I'm not the only one who's crazy. There are other people just like me. And once you find out that a lot of the traumas you've experienced are, you know, collective, then you start thinking, well, maybe there's another cause besides just me. Perhaps there is something wrong with the way society is structured. Perhaps there is something wrong with the way women are educated. Perhaps the way that there is something wrong with the sell, the hard sell toward being a docile, passive creature, as not being the end-all and be-all of humanity.
Did the group any of the groups that you've been associated with ever decide that it really was something wrong, there really was something wrong with a particular person who was bringing up a problem? That there were some ways which she could have changed that would have helped it any? They never decided that?
I don't think the group ever decided. I think personally some of us decided that, you know, wow, I really messed that one up kind of thing. Or, you know, here's a way I could change that would be very constructive.
But how would you learn that if you didn't get it from the group? So it's assuming that you were in a particular situation when you went in and told your story, yeah.
Someone could tell how they would have reacted to it.
Mm-hmm. So that's all right to do that.
Well, it's not. You're not putting them down. You're just saying, well, I would have reacted in a different way. Mm-hmm. Not saying it was better or anything.
Mm-hmm. But some of the kinds of problems that we have, all kinds of societal differences probably wouldn't make any difference, would it, unless we changed whatever it was that was dysfunctional in our relationship to other people? That's no reason for putting them down, I'm sure, but...
We got into this a little bit, where a person was having a particular kind of problem, and it somehow resolved itself to a personality problem, like maybe they were pushing or trying too hard, or maybe they were tense or nervous and made other people nervous because of this. And if you reach a certain level of trust, and you realize that you're there to help each other, that it isn't a confronting or cruel or harsh kind of thing. In fact, it's really immensely supportive. And I think you very constructively can help each other in saying, you know, perhaps if you could, or do you know that you were always wringing your hands in terror kind of thing when you're talking? No, you know, I never realized that I did that. And these kinds of personal characteristics that frequently you don't recognize that you have, that other people see, that sort of hidden part of yourself.
You know, when you say it's not a confronting kind of group, how would you define this in relationship to the encounter group, for instance? Have you ever been in an encounter group?
Yeah, I've been in several because of, well, my degree is in human relations here at KU, speech, communications, human relations. And so I've been involved in several. And I'm finding that the process that the consciousness raising group goes through is very similar to the encounter group. In other words, you sort of have this period of feeling everyone out, then you have this period of time of building trust and rapport, and then's when you really start getting down to the basic issues, after those things, preliminaries are established. And so that the group processes, I think, have a lot of similarities.
Excuse me, we'll have to pause now for station identification. Good evening again. We're discussing tonight women's consciousness raising groups. We may even mention men's consciousness raising groups before the hour is over, but at the moment we've been talking about women's consciousness raising groups. And we just raised the issue and discussed it a little as to what was the connection between the consciousness raising group and the encounter group. And Q Striegel was explaining her point of view toward that. Is there anything further that needs to be said, Q, about it?
Well, we broached the issue of being confronting or supporting in a consciousness-raising group. Now, the other girls might check to see if this has been their experience, too. Basically, my experience has been that the encounter groups were more confronting and had somewhat more hostility along with the supportiveness, whereas the consciousness-raising group was infinitely more supportive. There was a lot warmer, freer kind of open affection and concern. And, of course, I think the major difference is that the consciousness-raising groups are women dealing with other women, and they don't find the need for the dominance and the hostility and the aggressiveness that most men define their masculinity by. And so that, in many ways, I find them more supportive, much more warm, much more humanistically oriented than I have encounter groups, which is perhaps not a fair thing to say since there are no men here to defend themselves. But at least that's been my experience. Right, they can call it.
Our telephone number is 864-4530. And if you have a comment or a question, well, feel free to call this open line. And we listen to your comment or attempt to answer any question that you might have. I take it from what you're all saying about the supportive nature of the consciousness-raising groups that this must take a little time, at least, to develop, doesn't it? This doesn't happen just a minute eight or ten women get together. Eight or ten women are often together. What are they doing? What are they talking about? We wouldn't call them consciousness-raising groups, would we? Yeah.
But the coffee clatch that you kind of think of in the mornings,
or just the separation at a party,
yes,
with the men going one way and the women going another to discuss. I'm not sure any of us ever remember afterwards what was discussed. Are these the kinds of things that you can remember when you go home from one of these meetings? Do you remember what was discussed?
Oh, yes. Vividly, as a matter of fact. Sometimes for days, it's a very vivid experience. I think many of them are highly emotionally charged, one way or another, that the emotions run the gamut. But we found certainly that there was a very strong impact. And a lot of us felt very compelled to want to go home and talk about the experience with our families, and, you know, always talking about X, Y, and Z rather than sort of naming names. But
Do you find that the families, that you can make it clear? Can you be articulate to your other friends and to your families after such a meeting as to what really happened? Or is it something you must experience?
You can't really make it clear, but you can want to talk about it anyway.
You can make them understand it a little.
It depends on the person and perhaps how much sympathy they have toward it.
If it's someone that you know really well and that trusts, that you trust, then you can talk about them fairly well to the things that happen in a consciousness-raising group. But someone I don't know or someone I don't trust a whole lot, I don't think I could talk about things that happen in consciousness-raising groups to them.
And then, of course, I think there are just some issues that, even though you feel very deeply about them, you wouldn't discuss at all because they're either of a highly personal nature or because it was such an experience that was bounded by a certain context that it would be totally unexplainable to someone else. And I think people just instinctively know when that is.
I have asked a lot of questions and heard people attempt to explain some things which you almost have to experience yourself before you really can explain it to someone else. They can tell you it was a wonderful experience, but it's sometimes extremely difficult for them to get down to earth of what kind of things did you talk about? Which is one of the things I liked about this article, because it was very specific about the kinds of things they talked about in the group, and I'd like to ask you what you think of some of them. What do you think about the question of who do you usually confide in? Is that a good question? Is it a way to define your feelings about trust and friendship? Did you ever use it? What do you think about it? Raising this as a question.
We used it. I think most of... I don't know. I'm trying to remember. We did that rather early in the semester. Didn't most of the women confide in other women?
Yeah, most of them confided in other women except for one or two who also confided in men, but they were
specific men, like boyfriends.
What kind of other women? Other women their own age, their mothers, their sisters, their friends, or strangers? People sitting on the bus next to them?
Mostly friends their own age.
Friends their own age?
They had a few friends that they would confide in.
Is there any difference, you think, in age level? Was that your experience, too?
Yes, it was. See, everyone I've ever heard talk about it, especially in the consciousness raising group, mostly wanted to talk about personal things to people their own age.
Mm-hmm. And to other women.
And to other women.
Does it make any difference that you're not ancient, Q, but not in the little older? Do you think it makes any difference with the age group? To who people confide in?
I think ours was very similar experience. Our group ranged in age from our youngest member was a college senior who was 21, up to people who were like 33-ish. And for the most part, they confided, well, of course, several of our members were married, and some of them had children. And so in that case, it would be either other women friends or husbands or boyfriends in some instances. But all of us in the group admitted that, you know, there were things that we would say to the women there in that group that we would never say to our families, really. And that you'd never say to parents or even husbands or certainly not children. And so
did
I
you say things in this group that share experiences that you wouldn't have shared with whoever this confidant was that they all seemed to have? Is there a difference there? And if so, what is that difference? Have you tried to figure that out?
There was a difference. And I think maybe it was because of the chemistry of the personalities in the group.
What do you
think? That bring out different things. And if you were on a one-to-one basis, even with a very close friend who was not in the group, the same thing wouldn't happen or wouldn't make sense to them.
Did you run across anyone in your group who said that she didn't have anyone to confide in? Or didn't feel that she could confide in anyone? Or did everybody have someone they felt free to confide in?
If I remember right, everyone could confide somewhat in at least one person outside of our group.
But I remember one woman felt very frustrated because her female confidants would always kind of not, well, they would half listen to her and say, yes, yes, I have that problem, and then go on to not talk about her problems, mm-hmm. and, you know, just wouldn't pay any attention to this woman, and she didn't know how to deal with it at all.
Now, that's a different definition of the word confidant, isn't it? That one who simply accepts. I mean, you feel free to say things, too, but there's no feedback from the other person.
Mm-hmm.
And here in the group, you do get this kind of
feedback.
Yes, you do get a lot of feedback. Mm-hmm. And I think everybody's very conscious of showing, you know, their reactions and their concern. And it's very mutual that way. You know, everybody has a chance to express, and everybody has a chance to get feedback.
Mm-hmm. And you never found yourself thinking as you related in this way to other people in the group, say to another specific person in the group, did you ever have any feelings of revulsion or of that, you know, I really don't like this person? That's a very human thing, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
How do you overcome that?
I think all of us in our group had moments when we didn't like somebody because of maybe something that had happened or something that was said or a situation that had arisen. It wasn't so much that you didn't like them, but that you were angry with them for that time. And usually, though, the good thing about it was that you felt free to say, you know, right now I'm feeling very angry with you because of, you know, the fact that you slighted this comment or that you were offensive in this way or you did something that bothered me. And sometimes you found out it was just a misunderstanding, and then it was over with very quickly.
But these examples you're giving, though, are kinds of feelings that one could have toward a friend.
Really?
Because they have things that, the things that you're talking about are things over which they have some control. They could have paid more attention. They could have responded in a different way. What about the person, your reaction to someone that is not about something over which she really doesn't have any control? And you didn't run across that. Suppose she's just not very bright, let's say, and
yeah.
You are, and so she misinterprets the things that are said, or she doesn't really understand what you're talking about, and you can't blame her, can you? I mean, you really can't blame someone if there's a sort of a veil over her mind, but at the same time, you do react to it. How do you keep yourself from doing that?
That's a good question.
Really.
We didn't have exactly that situation in our group, but we did have a situation come up where one person tended to bother, I don't know, in strange sorts of ways, other people. Mm-hmm. And mainly, there was a very sincere attempt on the part of everyone to try and understand why that person was that way, and to just accept it and live with it and just not worry about it, you know.
Now that would solve really the question that I raised then, over things over which someone doesn't have any control.
Have control.
Learn
right.
to understand it and accept it for what that person is really like. And
I think almost all of us realize that there's bound to be something about all of us that not everyone in that group is going to think is wonderful. Mm-hmm. And so that you know, we learn to live with our faults and our foibles, which seems to be a very human thing to do.
Did anyone, I take it some people left the group, didn't they?
Yes.
What kinds of reasons were there for leaving a consciousness-raising group?
One of the members in our group simply dropped out of school and didn't come back.
But that's over. You presume that if she had been here, she would have kept on coming. She was getting it. It was a positive experience for her.
Yeah, she would probably still be coming if she was still in school.
Well, did you have anyone who left, say, in disgust? I'm not getting anything out of this, so I'm not going to come anymore?
We had one woman leave because she felt too threatened by it, that she felt like it was upsetting her life, and at that point she wasn't able to cope with her life being upset.
How did you deal with that? How did your group deal with it?
Well, just listen to her sort of list her reasons as to, you know, she came one evening and said, you know, I have to quit for, you know, these kinds of reasons. And everyone just said, you know, you have to do what you have to do, you know, and that's
did they
okay.
Did you have to deal with that after she left in terms of thinking it through or figuring out your own feelings about her leaving?
We certainly did. You know, we talked about it, you know, with the people that were left, and just tried, I think, very hard to understand her position. Mm-hmm. And then it was pretty much dropped. You know, it became a past history kind of thing.
What, did you folks have experiences like that? Or anyone left because they didn't like what was happening to them or the way it was affecting their lives?
I don't think so. Remember. Mm-hmm. Or if they did leave. I mean, they didn't say.
So you weren't able to deal with that. What about the question of, do you feel like a grown-up? Did you folks ever deal with that?
Did we talk about
childhood anxieties?
Talked a lot about our childhoods and sort of compared them, which was an interesting experience. Just, you know, trying to figure out, you know, how did we get where we are? You know, some of us who come out of very traditional backgrounds, how did we get to be feminists? and trying to figure out, you know.
Was there any talk about fear of responsibility? We hear a lot about that, especially from some of the researchers who say that there are women who are afraid to succeed. Did that affect any of the people in your group, or were you able to verbalize that?
Well, most of us were already involved in a profession of one sort or another, or were out working, with the one exception of the girl who was still in school, mm-hmm. who was then planning on going to graduate school. And so most of us were angry at the fact that we weren't allowed to have as much responsibility as we
as
wanted.
Now that might affect your group more.
Right.
What about that among a college group? Is there any discussion there? Because that's something they haven't resolved yet. Was there any talk about being afraid of what might happen to them if they did assume responsibility?
No, we didn't talk about that.
Did you ever talk about things like the problems that a girl has in being too bright, you know, like men don't like bright women or they won't take them out, or you're being labeled feminist and therefore some kind of outcast?
Yes, we had a discussion about that one night. One of the women came to the group and was being attacked by some males that she knew because they were challenging the idea that, well, if a woman's a feminist, then we won't be able to open doors for her and we won't be able to pay her way when we go out on dates with her. And they didn't want a woman to assume that responsibility. They wanted to have all of that for themselves.
that were you able to talk about how that had nothing to do with the issue?
Yes, that's what we brought up. Well, I have been labeled a feminist, and men have been very startled to know that I took a children's literature course and that I knit. And that just doesn't fit into my role at all. It's rather strange to be stereotyped the other way.
As if nothing that would be classified as normal or feminine would do.
Right.
Also the part about the doors that, you know, there have always been men who have opened doors and others who have slammed them in people's faces. I haven't thought anything about them, and nothing in the feminist movement that I know of changes that in the slightest.
No.
People still, it's a matter of personal preference.
We always try to explain to men that it's a matter of convenience. If, you know, you're in a situation where you can open the door and it's more convenient than having him open the door, do whatever is sensible, you know. I've opened lots of doors for men carrying packages or, you know, this kind of thing.
So,
you do what is polite, what's sensible.
That's if you're a polite person.
Well, that's true.
Male or female, right.
But when some people talk about it, it makes it sound as if all men have always done these things and all women have stood back and accepted them rather than what the facts actually are. Did you ever talk about food? This seemed to be a good subject for this consciousness raising group of why people eat too much or go on diets. Or how important is food to you? How important was it in your childhood? Why do you cook? Why do you cook certain things? Did you talk about any of those things?
No. I think it would be a good thing to bring up.
I think that sounds like a pretty good subject.
Really?
We had one woman in our group who was a naturalist in terms of food, you know, very much into the brown rice and the wheat germ and, and this kind of thing, and pretty much a vegetarian, also very involved in yoga. And so we all got kind of a background in this attitude from her, and when we'd have our meetings at her house, she'd always have these natural, you know, oatmeal and nut cookies that were always delicious, and tea made from all these herbs, and that was always very exotic and exciting. And we did talk a lot about people being obsessed with, as you mentioned, like going on diets or gaining weight or losing weight, and these as people being obsessed with size problems, you know, because, you know, every woman in the world knows that something is wrong with her somewhere, you know, there's something wrong with her hips or, you know, her arms aren't right. Or as I was reading an article, one woman who was apparently gorgeous but had this real obsession about her nostrils not being the right shape, you know, so every woman has some sort of hang-up about herself as being imperfect, and you know, as if we're all supposed to be sort of Raquel Welch or a Playboy centerfold, which of course is ridiculous.
And it would be boring.
And would be dull, yes, immensely.
Did you talk about money?
Only the lack of it is most graduate students and students.
What about money? Is money is power?
As power,
or is
it
instrument of self-indulgence or self-satisfaction or what it means to have a lot or not to have any? It sounds as if you both talked about what
a lot
it means
of us
not to have any.
We're graduate students and sort of struggling through at that particular kind of level. So only kind of in sort of joking, passing references. But we didn't ever really get into the power issue in terms of money. Maybe because we just weren't at that position yet.
What about the subject of jealousy? Expressed either toward other women, this question of physical attributes that you're talking about, jealousy about a man. Is this a subject that you ever discussed? Or would it be a good one for a consciousness-raising group?
Yeah, I think it's an excellent group for discussion because I think women are very much conditioned and trained to regard each other as competitors rather than as, you know, friends, confidants. And there's one of the glorious things I find about the feminist movement is that women have all of a sudden realized that they can be friends and have so much more in common and that they have so much to share with each other. And that all those rather petty jealousies that we had because we were taught that every woman is your enemy, you know, your one purpose in life is to catch a man, and so every other woman who lives is in competition with you, and you have to hate them all, and you try to, you know, that whole really ridiculous rat race.
Well, since jealousy is a pretty common emotion, you may very well have discussed it in some other kind of context, but... One of the things that is discussed. I mean, this is a subject which is discussed in some consciousness raising groups in terms of, you know, how to make you feel. How do you try to control it? Should you try to control it? You know, what's it really like? And what's the composition of it? Why do you feel it toward other women? Why do you feel it toward men? What about discrimination? You ever talk about that? Or is it a good topic, whether you talked about it in your particular group or not?
I think it's one that women need to understand, certainly. I suppose if there's any area where I've found a lack of understanding or knowledge, it's in the area of, you know, how discrimination takes place. You know, how can a woman not get equal pay for equal work? Or how can there be subtle kinds of discriminations by calling the men orderlies and the women some other name? You know, aides, for example, and then you can pay them different wages for doing exactly the same work. Mm-hmm. I think all women need to be tuned in to the various kinds of problems that arise so that they can be aware of them when they, you know, start facing their own lives,
if they're all career-oriented.
Yeah, and in our group, we also mentioned a few times the more subtle kind of discrimination that goes on, for instance, in classes where men are taken a little bit more seriously than women whenever they say things, except in certain types of classes. For instance, occupational therapy, perhaps women are taken a little more seriously than men there. And things like this.
So everything's so sex type. They assume that the men don't have any reason for being there then, in case that's what they want to study. Huh? Mm-hmm. Well, for the, what about the non-working or the home-working woman who's not making money in the labor market? What discriminations does she feel, or can she discuss or be helped by? And
there's a beautiful article in May, like I think Women's Day, one of those kind of magazines that are at the grocery store, where it talks about the woman who had worked for many years and then became a full-time housewife, and her very radicalizing experiences with things like delivery men who would come, you know, 2 days late saying, oh, I knew you didn't have anything to do anyway, so I just put off bringing your telephone, you know, as if she had nothing to do but sit around all day and wait because she's just a housewife. Or, and the thing that I am constantly infuriated by, she was writing the example of trying to check out a library card where they wouldn't put it in her name. They would only put it in her husband's name. And they weren't interested in her occupation. They only wanted her husband's occupation. She kept saying, he doesn't want the library card. I want the library cards. Well, that's not relevant, you know. And I've been going through this with my dentist. You know, he keeps sending my husband all of my bills, and it really infuriates me, so I keep refusing to pay them until he puts it in my name on them.
The whole question of credit,
oh,
too.
Really?
Yeah, the woman's loss of credit when she gets married.
So infuriating. So those are different kinds of problems that, you know, those are those little, as Ms. Magazine, the very first issue, had a tremendous article on the click experiences. You know, those little things that just happen to you, and all of a sudden somewhere in your head you go click, you know, something is wrong.
But at what point do you go click? Is it after you've had some consciousness-raising experience, or does it just happen to people?
I've known some women that just happened to, and then they came running over and saying, no, I need, you know, to get involved in this because, you know, all of a sudden.
I suppose that I believe that nothing really ever just happens. I think you read an article, or it's been there all along, but you've passed over it until something activates that cue for you. And then when you... When your husband trips over one of the examples, tripping over something on the stairway and saying, why did you leave this on the stairway for me to trip over? one of the clicks.
Yeah.
Did I ask you about childhood, if you talked about that?
We did a little bit, yes.
Found a lot of differences and, a lot of similarities, too.
I was really rather surprised at one statement made in the Ms. Magazine article about it, that among the people in this particular consciousness-raising group, none of them had a happy childhood. Is that your experience?
No, in our group, it was about half and half. Half of the people felt that they'd had a very good childhood, and the other half didn't think that their childhood was all that great.
Yes, I think that it's real easy to fall into stereotyping, which is what the whole thing's all about, you know, the avoidance of stereotyping.
Right.
And so I was rather amazed to read that all of these women had an unhappy childhood, because I'm sure that there'd be those who would immediately jump to the conclusion that the only people who could profit from a consciousness-raising group were those who had had a miserable childhood.
Right.
So you've found it can be a good experience no matter what kind of
mm-hmm.
a, certainly
right.
there are some miserable childhood experiences, I suppose, for all of us, even those who had a happy childhood. It couldn't have been all happy.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's what we rather found was, you know, most people had had, a lot of them had had very normal kinds of childhoods with a couple of miserable experiences, but of course that doesn't make the whole period.
And what about the size of the group and the stability of it? What do you think is a good size, and what becomes too large or what's too small?
Well, our group ranged anywhere from 4 people to 8 to 10 people. And personally, I liked it when it was a little bit larger, like right around 8 people felt just about right. There weren't too many people, yet at the same time, there weren't too few people.
Mm-hmm. I think there have been some studies that indicated that a group can become so large that it is impossible, really, to relate to every person in it. And this sounds to me like the kind of a group where everybody should be small enough that people can relate
mm-hmm.
to
right.
one another. Just one final question. We're past our time. Can such a group be any fun?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yes.
Really. Mm-hmm. I think that's one of the great things of the women's movement is women getting together and find out they can have such a marvelous time with each other. Some of the most fun I've ever had. No question.
Our time is up. We have discussed tonight the question of women's consciousness-raising groups with Cindy Cassie, Connie Laskett, and Q Striegel. We appreciate you joining us tonight and hope you'll join us again next Monday night for a feminist perspective.